After Kim Brooks left her 4-year-old son in the car while she ran into the store, a stranger called the police on her. And a year later, Brooks was charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Here she is on CBS.
Every mother wants to be the best mother she can be. And so when someone suggests that you've done something wrong, it can be very upsetting. At the same time, I didn't really understand why what I had done was wrong or dangerous.
Later this hour, Kim joins us to talk about her book. It's called Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. But first, millions of rural households still don't have high-speed internet. And for those in farming, that makes life even harder. Here's Shirley Bloomfield from the Rural Broadband Association.
There's millions of people in this country who literally have no broadband access because that infrastructure is just not being built. And that is the part of rural America that really has the danger of being left behind.
That's all coming up on the special Encore edition of the 21st. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the special Encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, are we parenting in an age of fear? We revisit our conversation with Chicago writer Kim Brooks. She talks about that in her book out this year. But first, nearly all Americans now have access to the internet, but many residents in rural areas either don't have it at all or have service that's much too slow for what they need to do business. The federal government has taken some action on this by announcing more than $1.5 billion towards helping rural areas expand access. Earlier this year, we talked about this issue with Mary Hansen. She reported on this for the Illinois Newsroom, a statewide collaboration of public media stations. Mary joins us from WUIS in Springfield. Phil Johnson is also on the line from Newton in southeastern Illinois, where he owns his own farm equipment business. Mike Romano is with us as Senior Vice President of Industry Affairs at the Rural Broadband Association. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Phil, I wonder if we could start with you, and can you tell us a little bit more about your business? I mentioned that you are in Newton and you run your own farm equipment company. Newton's about half an hour east of Effingham. How long have you guys been in business?
We've been in business since 1995. We started out as farmers, so our business has evolved out on our farm. It was something like a lot of farmers. We were looking for added income. We started a sideline business, and it's blossomed into now a full-time business.
And do you sell to other farmers, then, it sounds like?
Yes, we do, sure. We sell to other farmers. We naturally surrounding farmers will come in. We have a brick-and-mortar store as well as an online store, so we also sell all over the world.
And what role do those online sales play in your business?
Approximately 70% of our sales is online.
Wow. So it sounds like then obviously running, with most of your business being dependent on online internet access, broadband access, is really just crucial for what you do.
Oh, very much so. Yes, it is. Being in a rural area, as you know, we're discussing here, does pose challenges because we just don't have the access to internet that folks in the urban areas do. Through the phone lines, like a lot of people can get good internet, our phone lines are so antiquated, we barely have landlines that work.
And so you use satellite internet, is that correct?
That's what we're currently using, yes.
And is that fast enough for your needs?
Yes and no. It's better than nothing, obviously. It is slow. The reliability also becomes an issue. Whenever there is a snowstorm or it rains, we lose service altogether.
Right, so it's kind of like when people have satellite cable, the problems they have when there's bad weather, that's kind of an equivalent for you, but instead it's your internet access.
Correct. And it does, for whatever reason, seems to be a little worse even than the satellite TV does. It's sporadic sometimes, and that's very challenging and discouraging.
Right, because when you're doing business with people all over the world, certainly they're not aware of that. They're expecting that you're going to be online and available all the time.
Correct. That's right.
We're talking with Phil Jensen. He's the owner of Jensen Equipment. Mike Romano is also with us with the Rural Broadband Association. Mike, is Phil's story a common one when we're talking about rural business owners?
Unfortunately, in many places it is. It's not universal. A number of providers have taken important steps to make broadband more available in rural areas. Unfortunately, even with the job many of them have done, the job's not complete. There are many rural areas that still sit with limited or no internet access availability. Satellite tends to be a patch in some areas, although I think the experience that Phil described is one we hear common as a refrain in many rural areas where that's the only game in town. I think in areas, even in areas where that is the only game in town, unfortunately, adoption is rather low because either the price is too high, there are caps on the usage, you've got the reliability issues that I think Phil described very well, which in particular, frankly, both for homes and businesses can be very frustrating and sort of undermine the experience that folks are hoping to get out of their internet access. So again, there are areas where folks do confront the problems that Phil describes, and I think, you know, there's providers and the federal government both taking steps to try to address those. In other rural areas, I think in particular where there are smaller hometown providers, the folks who live in these communities and have sort of taken steps themselves to address it, I think the story is better. Unfortunately, Phil's just not located in one of those areas yet today.
And when communities take things into their own hands, Mike, what do they do?
So what we've seen typically and what seems to have worked best thus far, in many cases around the country, there are smaller local providers, cooperatives, family-owned companies, small companies that are based in the communities they serve. In many cases, these are companies that were formed to provide telephone service years ago when larger companies didn't come to deliver that. So in those areas where those types of providers exist and where they've been able to edge out into, I think we've seen success in terms of deployment of higher speed broadband, even fiber to the premise networks, which are capable of delivering sort of lightning fast speeds in terms of network capacity and reliability. In other areas, though, they're still sort of lying fallow, if you will, waiting for broadband to come. We've seen a number of different things there, everything from individual communities looking at what else they can do to attract broadband providers. In some cases, they might try it on their own as well. You've seen some other types of providers, fixed wireless providers popping up. So there are a whole bunch of tools in the toolkit and solutions people are exploring. Some are less proven than others. And then finally, again, the federal government is starting now or has been helping to advance broadband over a period of time and are now starting some new initiatives, including a couple that you mentioned at the start of the discussion here, to try to advance broadband even further and address those unserved areas.
We hear politicians talking about rural broadband all the time, I feel like, on a bipartisan basis. I want to bring Mary Hansen into this conversation. It's Mary's reporting that actually inspired our conversation today, and we'll tweet out her stories that she's been doing on this for the Illinois Newsroom. Mary, do we have any indication, as Mike is talking about what this looks like across the U.S., what does this look like across Illinois? How big of a problem is this?
So the Federal Communications Commission does track access to broadband, although there is some debate about how accurate those numbers can be. There's some different ways that they collect it, and so there's some question there. But in 2016, they found that about 38% of rural Illinoisans did not have access to broadband versus about 98% of those of folks in Illinois living in urban areas. So that's the kind of digital divide, the gap that that people often talk about. For Illinois farmers in particular, the Illinois Farm Bureau did a small survey of their members earlier this year and found that about two-thirds of them do have access to the internet, but then about more than half of those respondents said that it was that their internet access was so slow or unreliable that it actually impeded their business. So there was some some encouragement for the Illinois Farm Bureau to focus on access to broadband as one of their priorities.
That's Mary Hansen. Phil, as we are talking about this, I wonder for you with Jensen Equipment, what does the landscape look like? Obviously, it sounds like broadband access is not even a possibility in Newton. Am I correct?
Yes and no. There are wireless providers here. However, many people, when you say the word Illinois, they think of this big, large flatland, and not all of Illinois is that way. In our area of the state, we're far enough south, we become rolling. We have probably as much wooded area as we do farmland. So the trees become a real issue on being able to access a wireless tower. Virtually everyone, it seems like, is always looking for something a little better. We were in the past on a wireless, but the company sold out and the tower is now inactive. What we found even with it was that there are so many people that need and want and sign up for the internet access. I believe the towers become overloaded, and then it just gets so slow it's hardly usable either. So we're just all looking for more, I guess. Maybe that's the right way to say it.
Mm-hmm. And as we think about that, Mary, when Phil says he's looking for more, we've heard how it affects his business. You talk to Phil and lots of other folks in the course of your reporting. What are some other examples of where having or not having high-speed internet access makes a difference, in particularly when we're talking about the agricultural sector?
Sure. So I went to Lovington, Illinois, which is about a half an hour southeast of Decatur. And I talked to a couple of folks there. That town actually just got access to fiber optic internet. A small provider, similar to the ones that Mike was talking about, just built a fiber network there using actually federal grants and loans, using some of the money that the federal government provides for access to broadband. And so they do have very high speed, very reliable internet there now. So I went over to the grain elevator there, the Ocow Farmers Co-op, and I talked to Gary Smith, who is a longtime employee there, and he talked about the difference that made in their business. He said, it allowed them to have better access to connect more quickly to the Chicago Board of Trade, which is where they helps set the prices and where they trade grain. And so he said before it was the connection, before they got this high-speed internet, the connection was so spotty that often it was kind of difficult to monitor, and they felt like they were kind of losing out and not getting the best price for their corn and soybeans and wheat. And now that they have this high-speed internet, it allows them to have a faster connection and kind of makes the whole process go more smoothly.
And from those grants that Mary mentioned, Mike, I mentioned that total $1.5 billion in the beginning of our conversation. That includes $100 million for Illinois. Do you think that's enough, Mike?
It's a significant down payment. I don't want to minimize the importance of $100 million, of course, but it's more still remains to be done. If you look at the maps, even the areas that are purported to be covered or proposed to be covered, I should say, through those awards, there are still going to be other areas left behind. The other thing I would note, and this ties back to, I think, an important point that Phil made about network capabilities and congestion and the like, a significant portion of those awards actually went to the kinds of wireless providers that Phil mentioned. Again, these folks can play an important role, do an important job in as a tool in a toolkit in advancing broadband into areas that lack it today. But I think we do share some concern that if you're not building networks that are future-proof, if you're not building for anticipated demand over time, we may be patching holes, but we're not really building the house for the long haul, if you will. I think you mentioned fiber to the home connections, fiber to the premise connections. Those are the kinds of connections that ultimately are going to be built to last over a 20-year period. Those are the kinds of networks you need to enable the kinds of transactions that that Mary described in terms of pricing and things like that, where you need sort of instant action, reaction. Those are the kinds of networks that are going to enable that sort of productivity. There is some concern that if you're building networks that may patch these gaps, they're not going to be able to handle the types of additional demands, and especially as more subscribers hop onto the network, as Phil described. So it's both a case of putting more money to work and targeting these unserved areas, as well as making sure the networks that then get built are sustainable and built and can enable the kinds of uses that both Phil and Mary have described.
We just have about a minute left. So, Mike, I wonder if very quickly you could tell us what you're hoping to see, the Rural Broadband Association is hoping to see out of the Farm Bill.
So I think what we're hoping to see is additional support for broadband targeted towards areas that need it most, helping to finance construction of networks, because that's really what the Farm Bill infrastructure broadband provisions are about, financing networks in areas that are in need or helping to upgrade networks where they already exist. And an important caveat to that is making sure that we're not tripping over each other and already or building more networks in these very rural areas where they may already exist. So it's a very fine line between making sure the funds go to where they're most needed without also potentially overbuilding networks in areas where, frankly, even just one network is hard to sustain as it is in these low-density, very sparsely populated rural areas. But we're hopeful that the Farm Bill will strike that right note and produce resources that will deliver on communities and businesses like Phil's.
Phil, what do you want lawmakers to know about this?
Well, I guess we just need them to understand that some of us have been left behind. Many people who are accustomed to the urban settings just have no clue how little we have out here.
Thanks for sharing that, Phil. I appreciate that. All of the folks who are listening throughout the state hopefully have a better picture today because of you joining us. Phil Jensen is the owner of Jensen Equipment. I want to thank Mike Romano also with the Rural Broadband Association and reporter Mary Hansen from the Illinois Newsroom and NPR Illinois. All of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For the parents out there, imagine asking your child to run outside to walk the dog. Now imagine because of this, the police come knocking on your door. You might have heard this story when it made headlines here in Illinois. A North Shore Chicago mom made what seemed like an innocuous parenting decision to, as I said, send her child out for a walk with their family dog. But a neighbor saw this, thought it was unsafe, and called the police. While they did never end up pursuing charges, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services did end up investigating for neglect. It made us all wonder, are we making safe decisions? Should we continue to abide by the old adage that if you see something, you say something? Chicago author Kim Brooks grapples with these issues in her own similar story in her book that came out this year. It's called Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. We spoke with her from our studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Kim, this book came out of your own experience with parental fear. And I think some could say the average anxieties that many new moms in this age face, and then a less than average experience that happened to you. I wonder if we could start with the incident that prompted you to write this book.
Sure. So at this point, it was about 6 years ago. My son at the time was 4 and a half. My daughter was 18 months. And I lived in Chicago, but I'd gone home to Virginia with my kids for a week to visit my parents. And it was the last day of our visit. It was a cool day in March, and I was frantically trying to figure out everything I needed to pack for our flight home. And I realized that I needed one item, the special headphones that didn't bother my son's ears had broken. So I decided to run down the street to about a mile or so to a store to get this one item. My son wanted to come with me, and I let him. And when we got to the store, he had found my mom's iPad in the car and was playing it. And he asked if he could wait in the car while I ran in. So I said, okay. There wasn't a great deal of deliberation. I knew that it was cool out, that there wasn't a temperature factor. And sort of, I think, in the back of my head was, I was home in Virginia where I had grown up, and, you know, I had all these memories of waiting in the car for a few minutes or even longer with the windows open while my parents ran boring errands that I didn't want to be dragged along for. So I said, okay, I ran into the store. I got the one item. I was back in about 5 minutes. My son was fine. We went home, picked up my daughter, flew home to Chicago. And it was only when I landed in Chicago that I learned from my husband that when my mom returned home from driving us to the airport, the police came to her house and they were looking for me. And they informed her that someone had seen me leave my son in the car in the parking lot, had recorded this on their phone, had called the police. By the time the police had come, I had already come back to the car and was long gone. But the person gave the police this recording, and then, you know, the police wanted to talk to me and potentially charge me with a crime.
And so when this happens, which is just, I can't imagine the feelings that you experience, and you write about this, the kind of, there's so many feelings that you go through as this is happening. First of all, the shock of everything when your husband tells you, and you're talking to your parents, and your parents are like, the police were here. And you wrote in your book that one of the many feelings you experienced, and maybe the most enduring one, was shame. And I'm sure there are a lot of parents out there who can relate to that a little, but for those who maybe don't, can you explain why you felt shame?
Yeah, well, you know, I suppose there must be some mothers out there, some new mothers, who are 100% confident in their ability to be amazing mothers and in every decision that they make. But I have never met many of them, and I certainly was not one. You know, when I had kids, I was in my late 20s. I didn't, you know, I hadn't grown up like with seven siblings taking care of children. I wanted desperately to be the best mom that I could be, but, you know, not a lot in my life up to that point of, you know, college and graduate school had prepared me for what it's like to be a mother, particularly in our culture where mothers receive so little support. So yeah, I, you know, to have to kind of in a very public way have a person, a bystander, and then the police say not just that I wasn't a good mother, but that I was had done something that made me criminally negligent. You know, my first reaction was, oh my God, are they right? You know, did I do something terrible and not realize it? You know, I think that I was very vulnerable. I felt very vulnerable and very sensitive to that kind of criticism. And I think a lot of the women who experience what I have feel the same.
Well, I thought it was so interesting that your mother thought she was at fault somehow for all of this. You wrote that. Your mom thought, somehow, is this, some of this my fault?
Well, right, because they, so the, you know, they had taken a picture of the license plate and it was my mom's minivan. And so the police show up at her door and they just show her this image of her car and someone getting out and saying, you know, is this you? And she's like, I don't know. I don't think so. It's my car. So there was just some confusion there.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Kim Brooks. She's the author of Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. When she wrote about this, and she's before she wrote the book, she shared this experience. And I want to talk to you about that. I know we're going to talk about how the law treated you and other women in a moment. And we're going to be joined by an attorney that you consulted for the book. But I want to stay with this sense of shame and fear and the fact that this really does seem to be an issue that people feel very strongly about. And I wanted to just ask you, as you started writing about this and sharing your story, you got a lot of comments from people. And what kind of things did you hear from people?
Well, the comments as I wrote about this and started talking about it, and still to this day, are very polarized, I find. So on the one hand, I have a lot of women coming up to me and saying, thank you so much for telling this story, for writing this. I've been shamed. I've had, the, you know, if not this, this experience, I've had other experiences where I've felt publicly shamed or humiliated or so insecure. I didn't even know that was, I wouldn't have even known to call it shaming, but now I see what that is. And we've had really good conversations that have started around it. So on the one hand, there's those kinds of responses. And then on the other end, I get a lot of, It's completely inexcusable what you did. You know, what a horrible mother you must be. You know, I would never, ever do what you did. You know, how could you do such a thing? So it's very, very polarized. There's not a lot sort of in the middle.
And that happened with some people that you knew as well. It was really sad to read an account in your book of a friend of yours, someone who was a very close friend of yours, who was at one point. What was her response when you told her the story?
Yeah, she just sort of said, "I think you made a bad decision." You know, which is not, you know, in the grand scheme of things, people could say not the most damning, but it was very hurtful. Most of my family and friends, I should say, were incredibly supportive. My husband was incredibly supportive. My close friends were very supportive. But this sort of shocked me, you know, because by that point, this was a few months after when I had started researching, you know, how truly overinflated a lot of our fears are about children in public spaces. And it sort of all seemed so obvious to me, so that, you know, someone who I liked and respected would see things so differently was a bit shocking. But I will say, and I write about this a great deal in the book, that, you know, upon further reflection, I sort of thought about all the ways that me and this friend had sort of been, without saying it, competing at motherhood since our kids were very small. We had two babies the same age. And the ways that I myself had probably, you know, boasted or, you know, been sort of just sort of low level competitiveness that probably made her feel pretty crappy too.
Low level judgment, right? Parenting, right?
Right. Low level judgment. Exactly. And, you know, and it's like, because we have this culture where, like, you know, nothing is sort of standardized or provided. So everyone makes a so-called decision of, you know, and I say so-called because often we make the only decision that's really feasible. But do you work? Do you stay home? Do you do daycare? Do you get a nanny? What kind of school can you send your child to? Like, we're constantly making these choices. And so if you can choose, then you can choose wrong or you can choose better. And so, you know, in reflection, I think I was not innocent either. Like, I had certainly done my fair share of judging, you know, up until this happened.
Kim, I want to go back to what you said about how we've overinflated our fears about children in public places, because you researched a lot of this in your book. And obviously, because of what happened with your situation, you also researched the incidence of children in cars. And of course, we all know that about leaving children in a hot car, it can have tragic consequences. How often does that happen? And I wonder, when we think about safety and the actual statistics of it versus our fear, where we're at with that.
Yeah, well, it does happen. It happens on average about 30 times a year that a child is forgotten in a hot car. But I think is an important distinction to be made is that usually when that happens, it's exactly what I just said there. It's that a child is forgotten. Often, you know, there's a change in the parent's routine. Normally mom brings to daycare, but today for some reason it's dad. The baby's in a rear-facing car seat. He gets distracted and, you know, a tragedy happens. So this is a real thing. It does happen about 30 times a year. You know, it doesn't happen in any way, any nearly as much as, for example, kids being injured or killed in just regular old car accidents. That happens, I believe, about 47 times every day in this country, not every year, every day. You know, as I started researching and writing about what had happened, I tried to approach it from not from a place of certainty or self-assuredness, but from a place of kind of genuine curiosity. Like, had I made a mistake? Had I done something that was dangerous? I considered myself a pretty cautious parent. You know, I put my kids to sleep on their backs and I cut their hot dogs lengthwise. And, you know, I did all the things that I thought you're supposed to do for safety. And so, you know, I was curious, how had I kind of missed this? But what I found is that, you know, no, it's really not an unreasonable risk to take. You know, a lot of people have said, well, even if it wasn't hot outside, anybody could come and snatch your child. Kids are kidnapped or abducted all the time. In fact, I learned that on average, you would have to leave your child alone in a public space for 750,000 years for that to happen, for them to be abducted by a stranger. That's how rare this is. And yet, you know, we all think about those kinds of disasters all the time.
And so, Kim, your book is part memoir, but also part of the exploration of the sociology and the social science of this. And you talk to sociologists about this in your book, and I'm thinking of a conversation you had with Joel Best. I wonder how he described how Americans in particular, we've changed our notion of parenting over the past 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, well, he sort of describes that, you know, sociologists tend to think about culture in terms of waves, that we have waves of social movements that take place. And what he said is that, you know, beginning decades ago, there's been this wave of a kind of fixation on child safety, a kind of moral panic surrounding children. So you can think back to the 80s with you know, the kidnapping scare around like the Adam Walsh case or the Eitan Patz case, the McMartin preschool moral panic where, you know, hundreds of preschool workers around the country were wrongfully arrested. Basically, their lives were destroyed and they were later exonerated over, the, you know, child molestation charges. You know, you think about the satanic ritual. I mean, there's so many, and it sort of starts in the 80s and 90s.
Well, and I used to think other low-level things too, right? Not as serious as that, but I'm thinking of my childhood growing up in the 80s and not being allowed to go pick fruit. I remember this very clearly as a child, like not being allowed to go pick strawberries because some kid had fallen down like a hole. And but so my parents would let me, but I would just have to sit and play by the car, right? So that would be, so then I would be sitting playing by the car while my older sisters got to pick strawberries because they were big enough apparently not to fall into a hole, right? And I think that's part of, that's a maybe a shade different than removed from what we parents face now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can relate to that so much, you know, and that's a really good example. I mean, while I was writing this book, I remember this day when I was scanning the news and I saw that there had been this horrible thing that happened in upstate New York somewhere where some kids were playing in a bounce house for a birthday party. And there was just a freak windstorm out of nowhere, 40 mile an hour wind comes through and like tosses the bounce house into the air. The kids, a couple of the kids were like severely injured. And like a few days later, as luck would have it, I'm walking my kids to the park and someone had like set up a bounce house for some festival. And my kids sort of run bounce house. And I'm like, wait, not the bounce house. Oh my God. You know, let me make sure it's staked into the ground, you know, because in my head is this image of these babies being tossed into the air. You know, so it's so hard when we read about things like that and we hear about things like that. And
or we see it in the news.
Or we see it in the news, right. At the same time, it's like what I try to get at in the book is it's not that those kinds of fears are right or wrong. It's just that they have a cost. And that when we think about making decisions that come from a place of fear, we can look at the benefit in terms of safety and risk reduction, but we should also look at the cost, like you don't get to pick strawberries.
We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll be continuing this conversation with Kim Brooks, the author of Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thank you. Welcome back to this special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in, I've been speaking with Kim Brooks. She's the author of Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. Back in September, Kim joined us at our Evanston studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. We were also joined by Diane Redleaf. She's the legal director of the National Center on Housing and Child Welfare and the author of They Took the Kids Last Night, How the Child Protection System Puts Families at Risk. Diane, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Kim, I wonder if we could go back to your story as you're talking about the story that prompted this book and this exploration and the research that you did. A year, so this happened, you said, about 5 or 6 years ago, and a year passes from the day when you left your son in the car for a few minutes. And during that time, you had hired a lawyer and tried to figure out if anything was going on. You don't hear anything for a year, and then you get a call a year later from the state of Virginia to you in Chicago asking if you're aware there's a warrant for your arrest?
That's right. Yeah, I was pretty shocked. And my case is a little bit unusual because the incident did happen in Virginia and I live in Illinois. So somehow, just in the bureaucracy there, I think there was just this really long lag between the incident and actually being contacted by the police.
And then what happened?
So I ultimately needed to go back to Virginia to be basically served with a warrant for my arrest, to kind of self-report and say I'm here and to be arrested. I had a lawyer already that I was working with. And so, at first I sort of, I write about feeling somewhat conflicted because, by this point I'd been researching this a bit and studying this. And I thought, I don't think I really did anything wrong. There's no law in Virginia that you can't leave your kid for 5 minutes in the car. Should I go to court? Should I fight this? And my lawyer sort of said, well, this would be tried in juvenile court, and juvenile courts are notorious for always erring on the side of, quote, protecting the child, and you don't want to lose your kids over this. And that was sort of a terrifying thing to hear as a mother. So I said, okay, that's fine. Just what do we need to do to kind of move on from this? And he was able to work out something called a continuance where I went to Virginia, I went into court. I said before the judge that I agreed to do 100 hours of community service and 20 hours of parenting education. And the prosecutor said, well, that's fine. If you do those things over 9 months and show that you've done them, then we will agree to not press charges. We will basically drop the case.
Diane, Kim was eventually charged with delinquency of a minor because, as she's saying, there wasn't a law against leaving your child in a car in Virginia. How often do stories like this happen where moms in particular are being charged or other investigations happen?
It's incredibly common, and it didn't get reported much until there have been some very high profile cases, generally involving more middle class and upper middle class families, such as the Métis free range parent case in Maryland, where they let their kids walk home from a park. And once that case was reported in the Washington Post and internationally, I actually got upset about it because we had 24 cases. I founded an organization called the Family Defense Center, and we had 24 cases, mostly involving immigrant and minority families, including one mother who had let her kids play in a park right next door to her home. And a number of cases involving cars, 5 minutes in the car running in. Sometimes the parents would be arrested, sometimes they wouldn't be, but they would face a child protection investigation. And we decided to write a report on this because the laws are so utterly confusing, give open-ended discretion, basically, to police and child protection to declare what they think neglect might be, that we decided we really needed to develop a clear legal standard for defining child endangerment, defining neglect more clearly. I have to say, in this regard, we were also helped by a mutual connection that Kim and I have, which is Lenore Scanese, the founder of Free Range Kids and now the president of a group called Let Grow. She has been fighting, you know, for the rights of parents to make these kinds of decisions and the rights of kids to play and be, you know, independent.
And that's what we're talking about here, Diane, right? I mean, I think we're talking about cases where there is not, I feel like I should just say this, just state the obvious, that we're not talking about cases where we think children are in cases of neglect or endangerment where their lives are at stake. But it seems like it sort of seems like all of these incidents are being lumped together in kind of an equal sense of severity. Am I right in understanding
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. I mean, we have actually a shocking statistic to me is that 74 million children were called to child, 7.4 million children, which is 10% of all children, were called to child protection authorities in 2016. 10% of all children.
Of American children. 10%
right.
of American children.
That's correct. And so we're kind of trusting these authorities to sort it all out and to just draw lines that they don't have the ability to do. And I also think that part of the whole function of this system is exactly to shame mothers and to because there isn't any other function that this is serving. Like, it's not really promoting safety. It's not like we're saying to somebody like him, hey, we think you really are a bad mother. No, we are trying to pass a parenting judgment that we as a society actually haven't made. Parents have a constitutional right to raise their children and to make these kinds of decisions. And yet we have these systems in place that have been empowered to effectively shame and blame mothers.
Kim Brooks, I want to ask you about the role that you think race and class play in this conversation. Diane, I'd like you to follow up. But Kim, one of your attorneys said to you, don't worry, they aren't after people like you. And at the time, you didn't think very much about it, but it came back to really, I think, haunt you later on. You write about this in the book. And when you went to court, you wrote, like, what if I'd had to defend myself? What if I didn't have a nice professional outfit like Ann Taylor Loft in my closet? What if I couldn't afford to fly back to Virginia? Kim, I wonder what you've learned about the cost of fear, particularly when we're talking about for women of color or for women who are poor.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a few different factors at work, you know. One is, and I know I'm sure Diane can speak to this too, but whenever we in this country criminalize something, when we criminalize a behavior that most people do, because we have a criminal justice system that's plagued by institutional racism and different forms of bias and is, you know, hardest on our most vulnerable people, it will always disproportionately hurt people of color, women of color, poor people. People without resources. So that's just sort of an across-the-board problem with, you know, thinking that, you know, the best way to help, somehow the way to help mothers and children and families is to criminalize something that many, many people do. That's one issue. And then I think that the other issue is that, you know, because we live in a society without any sort of structures in place or policies in place that support working mothers and working parents. I mean, the cost right now for an average cost for just run-of-the-mill daycare for an infant is $17,000 a year. For a four-year-old, it's $14,000 a year, and these costs continue to rise. So, you know, if we say that a responsible parent is a parent that either never lets a mother that either never lets her eyes off of her children 24/7 or a mother who pays another adult to watch her children 24/7, then you're saying that a good parent, a good mother is a white affluent mother. You know, you're basically criminalizing the parenthood of immigrant families, people of color, poor people, people who have other alternative childcare structures in place.
Diane, to that point, I'm thinking about another guest we had on the program earlier this year, criminal justice activist Susan Burton, and she had a mom, I'm remembering in her book she wrote, who was sent to jail after she left her daughter in a car for a few minutes. And she ended up not just in jail, but she lost custody of her children. She was Black. And I wonder, as we think about race, how you see outcomes differ for cases like these. You mentioned particularly when we're talking about Black or Latino or immigrant parents.
So I'll give the example of Natasha Felix, because she was a prominent case that we worked on for 2.5 years, and it went to the appellate court. She's the one who left her children to play outside and could see them from her window. But she worked in home health care. And because we have child abuse and neglect registers, which are determined by the say-so of an investigator, there's no requirement of going to court first to prove a case, she found herself in the child abuse register. And this has a dramatic, direct effect on the ability of people to work in child care. So I've heard statements that it's barring, 50% of the people who are on the register from actually working in their chosen careers. And so that obviously has a ripple effect on people's ability to support their families. That is a problem that I think especially plagues lower income people. And then, of course, as Kim was mentioning, there is just a disproportionate response. She writes in the book how she got, to be have her case heard more quickly because she showed up and she had a lawyer. Well, people who don't have access to lawyers, and there is no right to appointed counsel when you're dealing with the child welfare system, and people don't necessarily know to ask a lawyer until something goes wrong that's obvious. So that is also causing, a disproportionate response.
We're almost out of time, so we just have a minute left, but I just wanted to ask, and Kim Brooks, by asking you, I think, get to that point of what I started this whole conversation with, that we often hear, if you see something, say something. I wonder what you think about that now.
Well, I think if you see something, you should say something. You should say something to the person you see doing something that confuses you or that you're not sure about. I don't think there's any problem with people engaging with each other and saying, I see your child playing in the park. I see your child. Is everything okay? Or even engaging with the child. Are you okay? Does your mom know where you are? But what the idea that, the best way to make sure everything is okay is to call the police on people, that's what really disturbs me and seems terrifying.
Mm. And Diane, what do you think those, just if you're just in 30 seconds, I wonder if you could answer what you think those.
Yeah, we have what's called a surveillance society these days. And part of it is child abuse reporting being mandated just based on mere suspicion. And this is causing an overload of our systems, a massive uptick in the number of cases like Kim's talking about. And we also have, it's very easy to make the calls these days because of cell phones and the surveillance that other neighbors and people, anonymous people, are doing. So no, we have gone too far in this direction, and we are unable to distinguish the really serious abuse cases that require attention from the normal children who should be given the right to play.
And that's Diane Redleaf. She's the legal director of the National Center on Housing and Child Welfare. She's also the author of They Took the Kids Last Night, How the Child Protection System Puts Families at Risk. I've also been speaking with Kim Brooks, who's the author of Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. That does it for us today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that for wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. It's pretty simple to download. Then you can set your home station to get that news. And if you search for The 21st to follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the hour with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Our Facebook page, if you want to search for The 21st to like us, is another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.